Good morning and welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning. It's the 30th of April. It's the final day of April. Tomorrow it will be May. Are we keeping you up, Mr. Graff?
No. Okay. Heavens no. Gearing up for May Day, don't you know? Be marching around with my parade. Fisherman's hat on.
It's just so nobody will miss what was going on. Ray was yawning.
Yeah,
Freud said a yawn was a sign of repressed
pain. We know Freud was a quack.
Don't you think it's particularly problematic when you yawn when the program really hasn't gotten underway yet?
You're right. You're yawning. I should wait about 3 minutes. Yeah. That's a good point.
There'll be plenty of yawning opportunities.
Yes. You know, there's a fine line between problematic and normalcy.
Yeah.
But good morning. Welcome. Let me introduce the panel to you. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, sir.
I have a cousin who is an old psychiatrist. I think he's still alive. Yeah. He wrote a book called The Road to Normalcy. Hyman Chartok. I'd mention that.
Yeah.
Obscure but important.
All right.
Number 1 billion on the Amazon bestseller list right
now. When's the last time you saw Hyman?
No, he called me once. Yeah, he did. You lived down in Kingston. Yeah.
When's the last time
like
you saw
you.
Him?
And
you said
say?
He called you.
You
once,
never saw
when,
him, right?
When have you ever met him?
When I was a child out on Fire Island, he came out to visit for a day.
And you said, "Hi, man." No. Could be a yawning opportunity, right?
I'm not even going to go there.
Oh, well, look at the time.
Very nice.
I'm not going there.
Very nice.
You don't have to introduce me after that line.
No. All
I don't
right.
take
no,
any.
No,
just
no,
say
no.
goodbye.
Nope. Radio credits. Daily Freeman publisher emeritus Ira Fussfeld is with us. Good morning, sir. How
Good
are
morning.
You?
Lovely to be here.
Very nice to have you here. All right, let's get started and
you
talk
didn't
about
didn't introduce
what's
Ray.
Playing. Oh, didn't I?
No, it doesn't matter.
No, it's Ray. WAMC.
He did.
Ray.
Sure have Ray and loves
trying
him.
To get your name out. You get paid by the name, don't you?
Yeah, right.
Newspaper industry, they used to pay you by the word.
Now it's public radio. You get paid by the pause.
I see.
Yeah.
That's what they say.
Oh, assume. You know, especially around here.
The NPR pause?
No, because we have, Pets and Vets. Yeah. On our thing. And you said we get paid by the pause.
Oh, different pause.
That's right, P-A-W-S.
Okay, let's just start again.
Okay. Boy, if Rosemary would not allow this
no.
if she were here.
No, nope. Where is she, by the
allowed.
Way?
She'll be back next week.
Okay.
We're not allowed to say.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about what's going on. We introduced everybody. We welcome you to join us. If anyone's still there, roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. So let us talk about the update in Baltimore. Here's what we know real quick. I'll just try to put this in a nutshell. I sent a whole bunch of stories last night, but there was obviously there is protests. There are protests around the nation. There have been protests around the nation after a somewhat calming night or two in Baltimore. So there are protests around the country. We also hear the story. Late yesterday that a prisoner that was in the same van as Freddie Gray said that he was banging against the wall during the ride, perhaps in an attempt to hurt himself. And then also the New York Times is reporting about the mayor of Baltimore and treading a fine line in a city that obviously is very divided, coming under fire for using words like thug, which interestingly, also used by the President of the United States. And so I put all of that together, I present to you, and you can take a whack at whatever part of that you want to.
Yeah, go ahead, take a whack.
Well, this is probably the least important of those items that you mentioned, but using the word thug has now become a controversial item. That,
yes.
One person in Baltimore, a black man, and I didn't catch his title, and I apologize, was very critical of that the use of that word and became exasperated when pressed on it and then started using the N-word. You might as well just call him the N-word.
Right.
And I don't know where that word thug has become racially tinged.
I've called politicians thugs,
yeah.
and they don't like it, but it's hardly that.
Yeah.
It was a term, as I mentioned, used by the president, used by the mayor, and you're right. So it was apparently the Baltimore City Councilman Carl Stokes who said that we don't have to call them thugs, and calling them thugs is akin to calling them the N-word.
I don't get it. It meets what was going on in the streets certainly meets the definition of thuggery.
I hate to say it, but I agree with
you.
I mean, you know, you're busting a window down and you're going in and grabbing a television. What else is it?
Well, it just that sort of rhetoric it makes it difficult to zero in on the real problems when it seems like there's this false kind of racial conflict being established that now we're all arguing whether thug is a racial word when we again should be focusing on why this is going on, what we can do to fix it.
Defined by Merriam-Webster, defined thug as a violent criminal. So is that then to say if we call someone a violent criminal, then that also is a racial slur? Under that guidance.
Now that's interesting that you say that, because of course we know that a disproportionate number, for example, of people of African American descent have been imprisoned and have been arrested and have been stopped. So if one makes that conceptual jump, then I take it we get into racial politics.
In the Oxford Dictionary, looking at the British pronunciation, a brutal ruffian.
Well, you bust down somebody. You go into a CVS and you steal everything in the store, and you bust in.
Well, I do know that part of the concern over violent criminal was that innocent until proven guilty. Are they actually criminals? Is it violence? Okay. Well,
somebody went into those stores.
Somebody set the place on fire, right?
We got the pictures.
That's right. Somebody went after the fire hose with an axe. Yeah. So right. So.
There are times in this country, and if there were, I'm sure we have film, but even pre-film, when these were white people who were doing this kind of violence in communities, and they were thugs. So, it accurately defines it, in my view.
So then we look at what is happening over the around the rest of the country, and also, of course, what is happening in Baltimore. Even as demonstrations against police practices generated scores of overnight arrests across the United States, Baltimore, where a curfew remained in place, was outwardly tranquil early Thursday as a curfew remained, with the police and the National Guard out in large numbers and community leaders urging residents to go home. The streets emptied as Wednesday evening wore on and a second night passed without the violent protests that gripped Baltimore earlier this week. It seems it's safe to say that pretty much everything they put in place worked. And so far, things seem to be relatively calm.
I mean, the lingering question when they write the history of this thing is was the... Were the political people, the governor and the mayor particularly, too slow in organizing the police response? And could the first night of all the looting and fires, could that have been prevented or at least lessened?
That's a very good question. Yeah.
Right. I think it's interesting the profile of the Baltimore mayor, who is a black woman, and there is a black police chief, and there's a black president. And if people thought that the election of people of color was going to eliminate racism or the problems that Baltimore has exhibited, that's just not the case.
I'm so sorry, Joe, but I do think that what we're faced with now is we have major centers of poverty in this country that surely come down from the days of slavery to Jim Crow to the kind of racism that we see in this country. So either we're going to deal with that, or the alternative is that the middle class, which votes in much larger numbers than the poor, are going to say what we need now is another Giuliani. And I think that is what you really have to see, that there'll be a choice which is offered by people who say, I'm putting the lid on it, as opposed to people who say, let's make some substantive changes here.
I do have to say, just to Ira's point, I don't think that anyone, or at least it seems to me that it would be unfair to just think that because we elect African American politicians that they can eradicate a problem that has existed for centuries.
I think, though, wouldn't you say that when...
But at least understand it and be able to put some of the building blocks in place to address it.
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is when Obama was elected, you heard a narrative that this country had cleared a hurdle and that the election of a black man was something you could never have expected in this country, and it showed that this is a new day. and the kinds of racial violence and racial hatred that used to exist in this country was a thing of the past. And now it's turned out, in many respects, that it's as bad, if not worse, in part because the race haters have come out and not let Obama do his thing in many areas. I don't know. Everybody in this room saw The Wire.
Yes.
Classic.
Well, maybe not.
No, I didn't.
Not somebody who goes to sleep at 7 o'clock.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Well, all right.
So Ira and I have seen The Wire.
Yeah, well, The Wire, not so coincidentally, was a 5-year HBO series, extremely realistic, based in the city of Baltimore. And it covered everything.
Everything was in
everything.
Baltimore.
It was just tremendous. You really need to see it. But at any rate, one of the things that they emphasized near the end of that series, and it's something that I haven't heard discussed much in relation to the current situation, is the need for community policing. That is to say, the cop on the beat, the cop who is walking down the street, as opposed to the cops who are doing drive-bys and just busting the drug dealers, etc. And that there's a certain level of distrust on both sides, the cops and the community, because they don't know each other. They don't know their names. They're not familiar with their faces. They don't meet them on a one-to-one basis. And maybe if little kids who might go the wrong direction met the cop on the beat when they were in their formative years, maybe they wouldn't distrust cops. Conversely, maybe the cops would understand more about what's going on in the community.
Well, as you know, Ira, those things always have a second side of unintended consequences. For example, and I'm a great believer in a police presence to protect citizens if you have to do that. But when you get the cop on the beat, you also create, I hate to say this, incentives for people to bribe them. And that is one of the reasons that while we've experimented with this in the past, it becomes problematic. And they go back to the so we go back and forth between the radio cars and the patrol people who are walking the beat.
Hmm. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. I just presumed that the move to patrol cars was perhaps financially motivated,
cost saving measure,
and it more considered to be more effective because you could cover more ground.
It could be.
Yeah,
I think it's never one or the other. I think there's always a lot of things at play.
Let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll do a quick read of the letters, and then we'll go to our news break at the bottom of the hour. We'll be right back after the short break. Good morning. Welcome back to our roundtable panel. A quick look at the letters. We'll get to some more after the break, but we do have a few minutes, and we'll get to as many as we can before that.
Okay. And Angelique says, "Were the people who did the Boston Tea Party thugs? In school, I was taught they were freedom fighters." I'm not getting into that one. Okay, Carol Ann says, "Isn't the mayor's retraction of her use of the word thugs going to make anyone say the emperor has no clothes on? What happened to honesty in language?" And Carrie says, "Thug, as Tupac defined it, a thug is someone who is going through struggles, has gone through struggles, and continues to live day by day with nothing for them." Okay, and I'm not reading the rest because I have other fish to fry here. And then there's somebody who's writing to us with no name, and those persons, not while I'm sitting here, will ever get read on the air. I tell you right now, I am bothered by people who hide behind anonymity. George says, "The distinction in the use of the word is that white people commit the same acts, in other words, the pumpkin riot, various sports riots. They are not called thugs, no matter how thuggish their behavior. When the Klan or similar groups commit acts of terrorism, they're not called thugs or even terrorists." I don't know. I think the Klan has not done well in terms of American perception of their criminality and who they are. John says, "I think the panel's a bit obtuse about how language becomes racialized in political discourse. Words can have resonances beyond their dictionary definitions. When a right-wing polemicist called Obama a welfare thug in 2008, did that lack racial inference? Inference, I guess it means. Are white college students who commit vandalism and arson when the teams lose or win called thugs? I would."
Absolutely.
What'd you say?
Absolutely.
Sure. And Ethan says, "The police are the thugs. According to the definition, they committed violence, killing unarmed citizens. Let's get back to the case at hand. Freddie Gray made eye contact with the police. Freddie Gray began to run. Freddie Gray was chased by the police, harassed and harmed physically before entering the police van. He could not walk. Okay, and then it goes on, and Adam says, the word thug and term thug life have roots and a different connotation in hip-hop culture. Maybe that's why folks have reacted to the word becoming a media catchphrase. It's an easy way to refer to people, and young black men in particular, without doing so literally. This is from Adam in Florida. And Anthony says, really, is all you can talk about is the burning of buildings? Why don't you talk about the police actions? Well, we haven't done that here. We've never done that here. Please, take it back. The deaths of multiple people of color, the unemployment rate of 40% plus. I just said it to you folks. The police cornered students who were simply trying to go home. They cut off buses and made children get off buses. They set up a situation in a very tense atmosphere. And on and on and on. Okay.
All right. Well, let's go on and on and on after the break, and we'll just pause for a moment. We're going to go over to the BBC News. A reminder, you can join in on the conversation roundtable at wamc.org, roundtable at wamc.org. You can also go to the webpage, wamc.org/roundtable, and do all of the Facebook and Twitter stuff as well if you wish. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Ray Graff, Ira Fesfeld, I'm Joe Donahue, and we welcome your letters, roundtable at wamc.org, roundtable at wamc.org. I have the feeling I'm going to sneeze again.
Yeah. Allergies or you got to?
I don't know. Probably allergies. Everything's coming out. Sure. Okay.
Did anybody bring a cat in here for the, for the
Pets and Vets?
The Paw Show?
No, she may have obviously been in contact with animals, and she was sitting, I think.
A lot of cat calls yesterday.
Yeah.
There were.
Bernie Sanders knows he faces an uphill battle against Hillary Clinton for the Democratic presidential nomination, but he believes he can win by reaching out to overworked, underpaid Americans anxious for change. He is making it official today. The fiery 73-year-old former Burlington mayor said Americans are disenchanted with the, quote, greed of corporate America and with a political establishment that doesn't talk about the issues that affect people's lives. Again, he will make it official today.
You know, I love Bernie Sanders. I'm going to be straight out. I love the guy. I think he's an honest man. I think he's a socialist. He's a social democrat. People have been telling him, and he's 73 years old, which we have in common. And he is not being cowed by anybody. He believes in things. He believes that a few people own most of America's wealth, a relatively few people. He believes we could take that money and we could be progressive about it, and he's going to say so. Now, I think Americans like big ideas. That's why they liked Ronald Reagan, because he didn't say, I want the same old, same old. He said, I can change it, and I can change it for the better. And in some ways, he did that. I think Bernie Sanders is going to make the argument. He says he's going to do it basically a dollar at a time. People are going to give money to fund his campaign, and I think that they will. And I think if he catches fire, he has a chance of getting the Democratic nomination. I don't think he has a prayer of winning the presidency, at least not yet. But he thinks he does. And I think in the same way Barack Obama came from nowhere to beat Hillary Clinton because of Clinton fatigue, I suspect, I think Bernie Sanders is going to awaken a good part of the Democratic Party who really wants to see some dramatic change.
So you think that Bernie Sanders believes that he can get the nomination?
He says so.
Yeah.
And I have no reason not to believe him. Remembering, this is a guy who runs for city council in Burlington, doesn't make it, runs again, makes it. He runs for Congress. Everybody says, poo-poo, he can't make it. He's a socialist. He's this. He makes it. He runs for United States Senator from Vermont. And Bernie, not Bernard, as the New York Times puts it, but Bernie Sanders gets to be on the back of people's cars with one word, Bernie. That's all it says. You can't tell Bernie Sanders that he can't be president of the United States because he's defied all those odds all along.
Well, I defer to you as a political science and a PhD and whatever else degree you've got. I just think that Bernie doesn't have a chance to get the nomination. I'm surprised to hear you say that you think he does have a chance. So I start from the premise that he knows he's not going to get the nomination. And so if that being the case, why is he running? Is it simply to make sure that the issues that are important to him get the level of scrutiny that he thinks that they deserve? Does he think that he, by raising these issues, is going to make sure that Hillary is addressing these issues and will be able to carry the ball on some of them for him? Does he think he can become a cabinet person in the Hillary administration? It seems to be a long shot when he's a senator.
Now, he gets a free ride, right? Yeah. In other words, he's a senator. Yeah. He doesn't have to give up his Senate seat in order to do this. Yeah. But he is going to be 74 years old this summer.
Yeah. So I think the question for me is not will he get the nomination, but how much, if at all, does his campaign against Hillary help or more likely hurt Hillary?
Well, let me just, if I can, Joe, for one second, I just want to answer some of those questions. I have interviewed Bernie Sanders probably hundreds of times on the congressional corner as a congressman and as a senator, and I know one thing about him. He doesn't lie. He'll tell you that all of those things you just said are important, that there will be somebody in the race who changes the character of the race. He'll tell you that. But on the other hand, I truly believe he thinks he can win.
Hmm. Well, is that the Ralph Nader syndrome?
Well, let's see here before I take on all of the bad telephone calls.
Be careful.
Well, there's a big difference between Bernie Sanders and Ralph Nader. Mm-hmm.
So, but also, we're under the assumption, it seems to me, at least you're working with the assumption, that the Clinton campaign won't take a nosedive.
Won't?
Yes.
Yeah, it might.
Oh, I think he could hurt. I think anything that's going to bloody her up a little bit is.
No, I mean, if they self-implode.
That's a whole other issue. I think that's still a possibility, in which case then all bets are off. And then if Bernie Sanders is the only other guy standing.
He will not be. I guarantee you that. I take you back. I'm an old person here. I take you back to when Lyndon Johnson announced that he was not going to be a candidate for president. Then we had the stalkers, the people who sort of, I don't mean that in a bad way, but who came in and said, the McCarthys and these other guys, and they said they were going to do it. And then all of a sudden, Bobby Kennedy came out and said he was going to do it. And for his efforts, he probably got murdered. Don't know that, but whatever happened, he was out. I think that the moment Hillary falls, if she falls, you're going to find a whole hell of a lot of people, including the governor of New York State, coming in.
Well, but I think if that were to happen, the person who would go to the top of the list is Joe Biden.
Probably.
And would probably win by acclamation.
Probably.
Because I think he would be – if Hillary goes down, that kind of a scandal and all that implies is going to mean the Democrats have got to put somebody up who's palatable to the entire
country.
Well,
let's remember how this Hillary bashing got started. They look at the polls. Hillary is beating everybody. And they say, in the same way they've gone after Obama unceasingly, Obamacare bad. Now they're doing that to Hillary. Now, I got to say, there is some dissonance here in terms of what the Clintons have been doing that are occurring to a lot of people to be not good, catering to the rich in this country, one more group that caters to those people who can finance the campaigns. If not, a sense by some people that they're being bribed with $1 million, speaking engagements or $500,000 speaking engagements and everything. I think this could lead to some real trouble.
Yeah, I know you and Rosemary have gone back and forth on this. I agree with Rosemary on this 100%. I'm inclined to say I would like to see Hillary Clinton elected president of the United States. But the fact that I say that doesn't mean that I can't say that she has a lot of trouble and she's got a lot of problems that she's created for herself and that those things need to be answered. She's by no means a pure candidate on the fast track, and she's got to answer it for him.
Well, assuming she weathers this and she is in until the election, I think that maybe Bernie Sanders entering the race is a positive for her. In the end, what will happen is in the debates, Bernie will take a further left approach.
Yes.
And he'll take some of the flack that the Republicans will be prior to the election, in the primary cycle, will be throwing that way. And it'll give her a chance to show the voters in November that, oh, look at me, I'm much more centrist, I'm much more middle America. And I think that perhaps works to her advantage.
Do you think that there's any possibility that Bill Clinton called Bernie and said, Bernie, why don't you get in?
No.
You don't?
I think, I don't know if it's somebody, I don't know if Bill made the call. He may have been otherwise engaged, but no. Maybe
it
somebody
seems
did.
Like Bernie would by take way, that call. I think the one person that wouldn't take that call, it seems like Bernie would be the guy.
By the way, I know at this stage, I am sure, as Ian Pickett sits there and listens to this, he is going back to the last interview that I did with Bernie Sanders. And is coming up with his exact words, telling us months, if not years ago, that he was going to do this. He's planned on this all along.
When you look at the well, let's get to some letters. We have a break. We got to do a break.
Oh, so this
you
want
to do some letters?
Oh,
and
these
then we'll,
are great.
Whatever you say. Okay. Ken says, Bernie is not just running, he's leading. Leading a majority group of Dem progressives that are tired of being glad-handed. Bernie won't lie to them and doesn't come from the millionaire class. All Americans will get that, says. You don't agree with that, do you, Ira?
But, no, I think Bernie Sanders has a very strong message, albeit a limited one, in that he's primarily, I think, speaking to the middle and lower class and all of the very strong issues. But so I don't necessarily disagree with him. I do think he's limited in his field.
James says Bernie Sanders, by running, will, one, force Hillary a bit to the left in the primaries to appeal to many of the more liberal Democratic voters, and two, allow Hillary to look a bit more conservative, there you go, Ray, to the unaffiliated or undecided voters who will decide the presidential election. In all, it will be a big positive for Hillary Clinton. I think he knows it, and she knows it. Hats off to Bernie. Ken says, how does Alan distinguish between Bernie Sanders' current plans with what Ralph Nader attempted? Please explain the difference. And that's from Ken G. No. And Anthony says, what did who do? What did it says here? What did who do?
Is it Dr. Seuss?
I don't know. His presidency was the beginning of the end for middle-class Americans. His trickle-down theory created the... Oh, I think it probably is Ronald Reagan. Oh, Ronald Reagan, Dito good? Anyway, his trickle-down theory created the unequal and unfair economy we are now enduring. He was a mistake. And please don't tell me the Soviet Union fell because of Ronnie. They were circling the bowl for a long time without Ronald Reagan. Let me just say, I didn't say he did good. I wasn't a fan of the guy. I just said Americans respond when somebody says, I can do this, and outside the usual middle class, middle range political fare.
And by the way, presuming that Hillary clears the challenge of Bernie within the Democratic Party and gets the nomination, he would not hurt her in a general election the way Ralph Nader hurt Al Gore because he ran as a third party. I'm starting from the premise that Bernie Sanders is not going to run regardless of whether he gets the
Democratic. It'll take me the next hour to tell you why I consider Nader to be off the charts. Okay.
Feel the same way about Ross Perot?
No.
No?
Roxanne Nagorka says, thug. Hello, all. Regardless of the defense of the usage of the word thug to describe looters, I do strongly believe it is wrong to use it. Why? Because it defines the mostly teen looters who have grown up in violence and impoverished neighborhoods, immersed in a life unknown to middle-class people. And then Tony says, because the GOP is a wacko party, any Dem nominee gets a leg up. Also, we are mortal humans, so getting the nom of either party means that the death of the other mixes things up. Ray, did you want to say something?
Just what?
Yeah, what?
Aren't the Bowery Boys thugs? Remember the Bowery Boys in the
movies?
Them
very
the
well.
Lower, the Lower East Side. Poor
Bugsy.
White kids,
Bugsy.
and that's what they were in that era. They were happened to be white, and they were accurately described as thugs.
Okay, Ryan says I will be voting for Bernie Sanders. He's an amazing person and a far better person to vote for than Clinton, even if he can't win the presidency. I have to vote my conscience. I can't vote for another war hawk who is of questionable moral fiber, if one group's terrorists are another group's activist heroes, writes a long letter. This is longer than allowed. Perhaps it'd be worth pondering regardless. Well, we'll ponder it, but not on the air. Okay, so let's see. Gina says, similar to the adjective of the word ghetto, which is usually used to describe a black person who is less affluent, the word thug is rarely used to describe white people engaging in the exact same behavior. See all the rioting, destruction of property when a sports team wins or loses. These are not thugs, but revelers. I think you'd have to buy the premise to buy that gag. And EJ says, Alan, I love you, man. You're funny as heck.
Really?
Just kidding. Keep it coming.
Oh, that's good.
All right. Let's take a break. We'll come back and wrap up for the roundtable panel. We would love to hear from you as well. Roundtable@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Apparently we're in traffic. I don't know what happened.
Good stuff.
All right. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. We have 10 minutes left, and let's see what trouble we can get into in that period of time. We will begin with the issue of the federal death penalty. Who wants to talk about this? For a moment last year, it looked as if President Obama and the administration was moving forward toward a history-making end to the federal death penalty. A botched execution in Oklahoma brought national attention to the issue. Public opinions began to shift, and President Obama declaring that it was time to, quote, ask ourselves some difficult and profound questions, directed Attorney General Eric Holder to review capital punishment. At the Justice Department, a proposal soon began to take shape among Mr. Holder and senior officials. So now this seems to be, the administration seems to be backing off as the idea never gained traction, and the president has seldom mentioned the death penalty review since. Now, as the Supreme Court considered arguments Wednesday over whether lethal injection as currently administered was unconstitutional, the obstacles the Obama administration faced provide vivid examples of just how politically difficult the debate remains. I know you had a great box pop on this.
We did.
Tuesday.
You know, and almost everybody who called was opposed to the death penalty. But that may have more to do with who our audience is than anything else. I think Americans, by and large, certainly true in the Shania case in Boston, are opposed to the death penalty. There are those who say, okay, put them in jail for the rest of their lives. Let them rot. I say that's fair enough. Just don't let them out. Don't tell me that their character has changed when they've left three victims dead on the floor. You know, so that's not really an alternative. And there were people who called me up and yelled at me for that and said, no, people's character does change. Yeah, but there are three dead people on the floor. So I'm for that. On the other hand, the day that you make that decision, there will be a whole group of Americans who now say, why should we be spending $80,000 a year to feed and house somebody who killed people? You know, just get rid of them. And, of course, we know the answer to that is that, you know, that it costs a fortune because of all the protections, which don't always work, do it right and to make sure, because it costs more to execute than it does to put them in a cell.
If Obama came out to the Rose Garden today and said we no longer want to have a federal death penalty, can he do that unilaterally? What's the procedure there? Is it simply a decision that the Justice Department can make on a case by case basis? To if they go to trial, can they say we are not seeking the death penalty in this case?
On the federal level.
Yeah, on the federal level.
I think the answer to your question, I think, is yes.
I think he can do that. Yeah, and so that, thus, if that's accurate, it surprises me that he would not be paying more attention to this at this point in his administration, because if he in fact believes that the death penalty is not warranted, it's just not the thing for this civilized country to do, now's the time for him to be doing it, just as he's doing other things that he's doing because he doesn't have to get up for re-election.
But he has said in the past that he thinks that the death, I believe I'm right about this, that the death penalty is appropriate in some cases.
Well, his new attorney general says, quote, an effective penalty.
You know, a lot of people have lost political office, lost political favor, even though he can't run again, based on the death penalty. Mm-hmm. Certainly it was one of those things around Mario Cuomo's neck that never went away. And in the end, when he finally lost to George Pataki, it was a Republican year and all of that. It's very hard to know what happened. But certainly the death penalty was a part of it.
Yeah. So why do you suppose he's letting this go when he doesn't?
Because I think he may believe in the death penalty.
Well, that's different. If he believes in it, he believes in it. I'm one of those who does not. I'm one of those who believes it's an eye for an eye is not appropriate for the country and the government to do.
Yeah,
and
but you're not him. That's
no,
the
no.
point.
Well, I'm a voter.
Yeah, that's all. Yeah, and our audience clearly doesn't want to see the death penalty. I don't want to see it.
All right, let's move on to two more issues. One is a dimmer New York City skyline. It's New York's plan to save energy, and that may mean a dimmer skyline. You know, it's glimmering, it's grand, it's beautiful, but is it environmentally efficient?
Is it necessary to see it from space?
Amid a far-reaching push to reduce New York's environmental footprint, city officials on Wednesday weighed a city council bill to limit internal and external light use in many commercial buildings when empty at night, a change that could affect some 40,000 structures and rethink the shape or at least the hue of what residents see when they look up in
the
city of New York.
My heart and my brain are at dissonance on this. Clearly, it is correct to save that energy. Clearly, it is right from an environmental point of view and everything else not to do it. That's the brain part. Then there's, you know, New York. There's New York.
I got news for you. Put LED lights in. You'll save 60-70% on the electricity and still have plenty of light for your lovely skyline that you admire so much.
That's a good point, Ray.
But there is, and maybe the LED lights would obviate the problem, but there could be a security problem if the lights are low, too low or not at all, where there are security cameras, where there are police who are driving by, you know, street level buildings and might see intruders currently and could not if the
buildings
were dark.
We're not talking about street lights, though, are they?
We're not talking about street lights.
Not street lights,
in the store.
Street level store.
Had to be a bank. Yeah.
Yeah, the overall light that is available sort of casting a shadow over in the city.
You know, light pollution is a terrible thing, too. It's nice to be able to look up in the sky and see the stars. Even in towns, you can't do that anymore.
Yeah, well, you live in New York City. There are certain expectations.
Well, on your rooftop penthouse garden, you can look at the stars, right?
So then the issue...
Oh, you don't have one?
Then the issue also becomes city officials express misgivings about playing favorites with cherished destinations, potentially empowering government workers to decide which structures were notable enough to stay lit. And who wants to take on that job?
Oh, so you're going to the Chrysler Building, the Empire State Building, they're allowed to be symbols. But if you just happen to own some 100-floor, you know, new apartment building or whatever,
no light for you.
So turn the wattage down 20%. I mean, you'll save money. You can compromise on this. You can still have lights and safety, and you can, you know, change your lights like
and
they're
what
doing
about
in
those,
some.
What about those, you know, monarch butterflies and things like that?
Huh?
Well, yeah, the monarch butterflies. One of the reasons is to protect the monarch butterflies.
Well, there also is an environmentalist who said he was concerned about the frogs' mating activity.
Wasn't there a concern about birds flying
in the windows
where they can't see that there's a window there?
Another concern. Yeah.
Well, we have that in Great Barrington
as well.
The great metropolis of Great Barrington.
Yeah, yeah. Cardinals come and shoot themselves in the
Stan Musial.
That's
Red
another
Shane
show.
Dienst.
So this seems like a perfect time,
good one, Ira.
A perfect time to change the subject and talk about the jobs most likely to make you drink.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Roundtable panel, number one answer.
Roundtable listener, 1A.
So drinking jobs, drug jobs. This I don't know why this is fascinating, but here's where the numbers break down. This is from the Washington Post. According to the three highest professions – for drinking, mining.
Okay.
Mining.
Okay.
Mining, construction.
Yeah.
And hotels and restaurants.
But this is not, is this saying those are causing people to drink, or those people who are in those professions like to drink?
Or attracted to those professions, right? I agree with you, Ray.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll get to that. I'll get to
hosting a round table makes you drink. Okay.
Now, percent of employees who use illicit drugs, hotels and restaurants, arts and entertainment.
Surprise.
And management would be the top three.
I would be in two of those three, and I don't.
No.
And,
but don't you think there's a – I mean, I'm trying to word this carefully. There's a demographic element here for both of those categories, that you're mining and construction, typically the blue-collar workers who go into the corner tavern to have a few beers after work, the arts and entertainment, management, where people have a few more bucks, and they may likely – their drink of choice is not a drink but is cocaine. I mean, that – I don't know if that speaks to the stress.
Right.
It might speak to what they go after.
I think the headline of this is incorrect. It says things that make you drink. And I think it's quite the opposite. I think some people, like artists, might be more...
Yes.
More.
Well, the drafters of the study in our last 30 seconds say it's important to note that much of this variation isn't necessarily a direct function of the nature of the work in these industries, but rather of the types of people who work
right.
in them.
Uh-huh. Right.
Agreed. There you go.
Well, it's 5 o'clock somewhere.
And they will say you might take comfort knowing that your kids' school teachers are among the least likely to be heavy drinkers or drug users. So we add that as another reason to
salute
our teachers.
Well, not till they meet a governor who wants to have their
scalps. Oh, here we go.
Let us thank Ray, Ira. Thank you very much
Pleasure.
For being with us.
You put me last because of what I just said, didn't you?
No, because we're going overtime.
Oh, yeah, we are.
Yeah,
oh,
we're going overtime.
We screwed it up.
We're doing the roundtable debrief with a man by the name of Dr. Brian Fallon from the Columbia University Lyme Research Center, who will present the latest on Lyme disease. He'll talk to us after this.